Om namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay, I'm going to read text 9, but text 9 refers back to text 8. So let's read text 8 one more time and then 9. Text 8. Yasya brahmeti samgyam kvachadapi nigameyati jinmatrasatapi. Okay. Om sho yasyam shakaik swayar vibhavati vashayan eva mayam pumamscha. Ekam yasya eva rupam vilasati paravyomni narayanakyam. Sak Shri Krishna Vidatam Swayamiha Bhagavan Prema Tat Pada Bhajam. In the abstract feature of pure spiritual existence, the Supreme sometimes indeed goes in the Vedic texts by the name Brahman. In the partial expansion as the Lord of creation, that Supreme regulates the Maya potency of material nature and exerts his control through further personal expansions. By the single manifestation of his personality called Narayana, that Supreme rules sovereign in the transcendental sky beyond this universe. May that same Supreme, Shri Krishna, the original Godhead. Be pleased to grant pure love to those in this world who worship his feet. Okay, now text 9. Now we go into prose. Ataivam suchitanam Shri Krishna tadvachya vachakata lakshana sambandha tadbhajana lakshana videya saparyaya videya tadprema lakshana prayojanakyanam artanam nirnayaya tavat pramanam nirniyate. Tatra purushasya brahmani dosha chatushtaya dushtatvat sutaram alaukika chintya svabhava vastu sparsha yogyatvacha tat prachakshadini apisadoshani. This verse has alluded to various topics. Shri Krishna, and then sambandha, or the relationship between him and the words that describe him. And then what we are enjoined to do, or in other words, abhideya, the recommended practice of worshipping him. And finally, prayojana, the goal, or love for him. But before, so those are going to be, in broadest terms, the topics of the Sandarbhas. The Sandarbhas will present how the Bhavatam has those as its topics. But before we can elucidate these topics, we must first settle the question of pramana, the reliable means of ascertaining facts. In that regard, since an ordinary person is tainted by 4 faults, beginning with incorrect judgment, his faculties such as sensory perception are faulty, and they are especially poor for establishing contact with a reality whose nature is supermundane and inconceivable. Okay, this is all explained in the commentary. Okay, now we're getting down to business. After invoking auspiciousness in the Mangalacharana, the author of a scholarly work in the Brahminical tradition is next expected to justify his work by stating how it fulfills the four prerequisites. Anubandha Chatushtaya. These requirements are often formulated as Vishaya Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana. I have Abhideya. I've fixed it already. I hope this is correct. These are the four. Well, if you leave out Vishaya, these are the three topics of Vedanta. Is it true that this is sometimes the four prerequisites? Because sometimes we have Adhikari and Prayojana, and I wonder whether I got this mixed up. Anyway, I'll proceed. I'll have to mark a question here. Is this really Anubandha Chatush? Anybody know about this Anubandha Chatush? They have four prerequisites. Adhikari, yeah. They're the same, but Sambandha has a different meaning. In Vedanta, Sambandha is the relationship between God and his energies. Here we're talking about the relationship between the book and the thing the book describes. The relationship of reference. I'll have to just do some research on that. Or could you take a look in Shabda Kalpa Druma. I don't know what to look. Maybe you can just look under Prayojana or something and see what you find. Yes, sir. Well, okay, but we want to find a description of the whole system of all four, that there's four of them and these are the four. Anyway, let's proceed as if this is correct. The author should first demonstrate that his book has a specific well-defined topic, Vishaya. Then, to convince the readers that his book will deal with the subject adequately, he should show the connection, Sambandha, between the topic that needs to be described, Vachya, and the words he proposed will do this, the Vachaka. He should also indicate the practical method, Abhideya, that he will provide to enable the readers to realize the subject. And finally, he should define the higher purpose, Prayojana, to be achieved by this realization. Now, this could be a textbook on anything. So suppose it's a medical textbook on internal medicine or surgery. So, the author in the beginning of the book will say, this is a book about surgery. If you want to learn how to be a surgeon, this is the book for you. If you don't want to be a surgeon, or you don't want to know anything about it, this is not the book for you. Then the Sambandha. In this book, we're going to teach you how to be a surgeon by telling you this and this and this according to this method. And then Abhideya will say, here's the methodology. You study the lessons. You go into the laboratory and cut up cadavers and experiment. And the Prayojana will be that you'll be able to cut people up and save their lives. Like that, it applies in all different topics. In Vedantic context, the word Sambandha is used to indicate one's relationship with God. But that is not how the word is used here. Here it indicates the connection between a description and that which is described. Systematic thought in India is called darshana, or vision. I guess you could also translate darshana as seeing. Well, vision, seeing, same thing. A word with different connotations than the Greek word philosophia, love of knowledge. Philosophia, I think the accent's on the penultimate syllable in Greek. Yes? Sorry? But literally, it's Sophia is wisdom. It's philosophia. It's love of wisdom. Philo is love. Yeah. Like a Francophile is someone who loves France. So philo means love. Indian philosophy is generally intended not for amateurs, those who love knowledge, but for those who in one way or another are determined to achieve the full potential of life. Philosophy is meant to be practiced with the definite aim of self-realization. Therefore, a serious work in any school of darshan should not only describe its topic theoretically, but also relate it to the reader's self-actualization under the headings of Abhideya and Prayojana. This implies that an author claiming to be an authority on darshan should be fully realized himself, at least within the scope of his topic. After all, he is responsible for teaching his readers the effective means for achieving an important goal in life. And how can he be relied on if he is only speculating about his subject? In this first prose anuchet section of Sri Bhagavat Sandarbha, anucheda may be translated as paragraph, but that doesn't exactly work out that way. Some of these anuchedas are quite a bit longer than just one paragraph. And at least in the editions we have, I don't know about the manuscripts, but in the printed editions, there are sometimes several paragraphs in an anuchet. And sometimes an anuchet goes on for 10 pages, the real long ones, 10 or 20 pages. Not usually, but a few of them are very long. What we've done, actually I learned it from Kushikrata, is to split up the anuchets when they get long. If you have more than one or two quotes, then better start splitting it up. Because it's hard, especially when you give a commentary on it, hard to follow, put the pieces together. So splitting up the anuchets is practical. But those subdivisions are done by us. Jiva Goswami didn't do them. Later on, not in the beginning, but later on in the when we get to maybe anuchet 12, we'll start splitting anuchets. In this first prose anuchet section of Sri Bhagavat Sandarbha, Srila Jiva Goswami points out that the preceding verse has already stated the four prerequisites, the last verse of the Mangalacharana. Sri Krishna is the subject of the Bhagavatam and of the Sandarbhas. The Bhagavatam is fully capable of describing Krishna, his personality, and his expanded energies. And the Sandarbhas will be an exposition on the Bhagavatam by an experienced and authorized representative of a Bhagavat school whose eminent members include Madhva Muni and Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. In the preceding verse, Sri Jiva's words, that same Krishna, Sa, Krishnaha, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Bhagavan, Iha, Swayam, concisely express that Krishna, as portrayed in Srimad Bhagavatam, is himself the absolute truth in all its aspects, personal and impersonal, complete and partial. In the same final line of the verse, the phrase, for those who worship his feet, tatpadabhajam, describes in essence the recommended means for realizing Sri Krishna, the standard method of bhakti yoga, devotional service, which begins with hearing and chanting about him. The word prema in the verse indicates the final goal achieved by bhakti yoga, transcendental love for Krishna, in which a devotee enjoys his own personal relationship with the Lord forever. The overall plan of the Sandarbhas is as follows. The first, Sri Tattva Sandarbha, will establish the Sambandha in general terms by proving Srila Jiva Goswami's thesis that Srimad Bhagavatam is the most appropriate source of spiritual knowledge in Kali Yuga, and that it thoroughly describes the absolute truth. The next three, the Bhagavat Paramatma and Krishna Sandarbhas, will elaborate on the Sambandha through explanations given in Srimad Bhagavatam about the special character of the personality of Godhead. What did you find? You bet. Okay, I'll fix it right now. Bhagavat Sandarbha. Wow. Okay. The fifth, Sri Bhakti Sandarbha, will present the methods of devotional practice through statements from Srimad Bhagavatam. And the sixth, Sri Preeti Sandarbha, will discuss pure love of God according to the Bhagavatam. But, quote, before we can elucidate these topics, we must first settle the question of pramana, the reliable means of ascertaining facts. We need to determine how, in general, human beings can arrive at a correct understanding of things. In Western philosophy, this is called the question of epistemology. They divide philosophy into different branches. Major ones are epistemology and ontology. And then there's what? Axiology? The value and purpose of things? But first of all, you have to deal with epistemology. If we're going to try to ascertain truth, can it be done? Can we know truth and reality? Philosophy shouldn't even start until you decide whether it can be done. Can you know things as they really are? And if so, the answer is yes, well, how can you know things as they are? What are the means of knowing things correctly? We use this word jnana in Sanskrit. We usually translate it as knowledge, but it's not exactly the same as the English word. Knowledge in English means correct knowledge. You know, we distinguish between knowledge and misunderstanding or ignorance. Not knowing, knowing wrong, doubting, not being able to decide. Distinguish from these, from not knowing it, not knowing at all, knowing wrong, or not deciding which way it is, we distinguish correct knowledge, and we call it knowledge. But in Sanskrit, the term jnana is much more general. Any awareness is a jnana. And we actually talk about individual jnanas to come and go. You know, at one moment I have one jnana, next moment I have another jnana. It's different than the English word. It doesn't really cover very exact technical ground. It's a very broad term. It just means awareness in general. Of course, then there's talking about the jnana that you learn from the Upanishads, the jnana which is the sadhana for mukti. That means spiritual understanding. But that's a Vedanta understanding. But the general sense of the term jnana is too broad for strict philosophical use. So another term has come up with by first Gautama Rishi in his Nyaya Sutras. At least he formulated it. It may have been used before him, but he wrote the sutras in the Nyaya school. He talks about Pramā. Instead of just jnana, which means any awareness, correct perception or correct understanding is called pramā. From the verb ma, to measure, prami means to distinguish or to perceive. And technically in Nyaya, pramā means correct understanding. Actually, I think he defines it as yatartanu bhavaha, which means perception which corresponds to the facts. In Nyaya philosophy is a realistic philosophy. It's assumed that the world is real, that what we're perceiving is real. Whereas the Advaitavadis say what we're perceiving is not real, and that the reality is something beyond our perception. So they're idealists. The reality is something ideal beyond everything we perceive. Whereas the realists say that what we perceive, that's it. That's the reality. Nyaya school are very radical realists. They have a principle, astitvam gyayatvam obideyatvam. That means astitvam equals gyayatvam, and gyayatvam equals obideyatvam. In other words, if something actually exists, it can be given a name. I'm sorry. If it actually exists, it can be known. So that's the answer to the first question of epistemology. If it exists, it can be known. They're very optimistic about that in the Nyaya school. You know, if it exists, it has to be knowable. And if it's knowable, it has to be nameable. If it exists, you can know it, and if you can know it, you can give it a name. Astitvam, gyayatvam, abhideyatvam. This is the optimistic, realistic view on epistemology, or the question of how can you know and how can you know. So correct, yatartha anubhava. Prama is correct understanding, or correct perception. But the strict definition given by the Nyaya school is, I think it's smriti samshaya vyatireka yatartha anubhavaha. It's understanding or awareness that corresponds to the actual facts and excludes memory, which is not reliable and is not any direct, it's just a secondary reflection of previous knowledge. And on dreams. It's dreams and memory that are excluded. Even though they may be correct, they're not reliably correct. You can't be sure that they're correct. It might be correct, it might not be correct. Memory and dreams. But other perception that, or understanding that corresponds to the correctly to the facts is called prama. Or real knowledge, correct knowledge. This is called the correspondence theory of truth. What makes you able to decide something is true is that your idea matches with the reality, corresponds to the truth. I think that ragi is a nourishing breakfast in the rainy season. That's my perception or my understanding. And I can take it every day for 2 months and see what happens and verify it, that it corresponds to the facts. Yes, it is true. It's wholesome breakfast. So that's a correspondence justification of that something's actually true. But the Buddhists, for example, can't use that method because for them there are no facts or there are no things. The world is just a flux of energy, just energy fields, and there are no things. Nothing lasts from one moment to the next, according to Buddhism. And the Buddhists, later on, after 1,000 years of being around, they started developing logic. And so Buddhist logic has to have a different theory of truth, because there are no persistent facts. There is reality, but the reality changes from one moment to the next. So there's nothing constant you can measure by. You know, you want to measure the dimension of this table. Sorry, but by the time your ruler gets more from one end of the table to the other, it's not the same table anymore. So you can't measure, you know, you can't establish truth according to correspondence to facts, because the facts don't stay there for more than one moment to measure. So they have to have a different idea of how to measure truth or determine truth. And it's called karyakshamatvam. You can't absolutely determine truth by correspondence to facts, because the facts just don't stay still. They don't last for more than one moment. But you can, whatever's useful to get something done. You know, you have some purpose. If the purpose can be practically fulfilled by presuming that this is a table, that is no table. It's just energy field. And it's not the same table from one moment to the next. But, you know, I need somewhere to keep my papers. And I'm assuming, I'm pretending, I have a fiction, an illusion, that this is the same table today as it is tomorrow. If I put my papers in the desk, tomorrow I can come and find the same papers. That's all illusion, but it's practical illusion. It works. My perception that this is my desk. It's my desk. I bought it. It's going to be here tomorrow. It's an illusion, according to the Buddhists, but it's karyakshama. It helps my pretending that it's a desk, that there is a desk, helps me, you know, get my work done. I can find my papers the next day. Somehow they're there. I don't know, you know, just the illusion persists, so the papers are there the next day, even though the reality doesn't persist. So their idea of the best they can define truth as is whatever lets you practically get something done. The illusion that has some practical purpose is truth. That's what, you know, the extreme idealists have a hard time pinning down truth. The correspondence theory of truth, corresponding to the facts, is a much simpler way of understanding truth. Okay, so by correspondence to facts, that other than maybe it's doubt, dreams. No, doubt is out of it. Doubt is not true. Dreams, which may sometimes be true, and memories, which may be true to some extent, a little distorted. Same thing with dreams. They're true, but they're not completely true. Things are a little distorted, and they may be wrong. And the same thing with memory and dreams. So they cannot be included under prama, real correct understanding. Prama is understanding that corresponds to the facts, but not just accidentally, or not just partially. That's where the term prama comes from. And then we get the other word, pramana, by derivation from that. Pramana would be means of getting prama. Pramiyate nena iti pramana. That by which you get prama, or that by which you correctly perceive, that's called pramana. And we can understand in English as means of correct understanding. Okay. Skip over this because I already spoke. I already said this. Here is the Buddhist definition of jnana, of jnanam, according to Nyaya Bindu, which was written by Dharmakirti. I think that's the one. He's the author. Dharmakirti, the author of the first century Buddhist short textbook on logic, called Nyaya Bindu. We have it in our library, and his definition of jnanam, or correct understanding, which would be prama, would be the term according to Gautama. He doesn't use the same term, but he's talking about the same thing. Avisamvadakam jnanam samyajnanam. True knowledge is knowledge that creates no contradiction. That's his definition, the Buddhist definition. If it's not contradicted, okay, let it be considered for practical purposes knowledge, even though there really are no things to be known. Okay. We'll discuss what are the different pramanas. What means are there for getting prama, correct understanding? Actually, that's discussed in Baladeva Vidyabhushan's commentary. Maybe there's some here in my commentary. And discussed at length in the Sarvasambhadani. And we'll look at the Sarvasambhadani for this verse. It may take us a week or two, but let's do it. Okay, continuing the commentary based on Baladeva Vidyabhushan. Sri Bhagavat Sandarbha aims at the highest kind of knowledge obtainable, personal realization of the absolute truth. In the present Anuchet, Sri Jiva Goswami emphatically asserts that for this lofty purpose, all pramanas are unreliable in the hands of imperfect humans. All pramanas are unreliable. Every person in this world tends to make four kinds of mistakes in perceptive judgment. Perception here doesn't just mean sense perception. It means all kinds of perception. Perception with your mind, with your intelligence, with your guts, and any kind of perception. These are the four kinds of mistakes in perceptive judgment. Brahma, confusing one thing for another. That's what Brahma actually means. Confusing one thing for another. As one sees a tree, when one sees a tree at dusk and thinks it's a man, that's Brahma. Mistake. Pramada, inattentiveness due to a distracted mind. As one, when one fails to notice that someone close by is singing a song. Vipralipsa, this is desiderative noun, the desire to do vipralamba. The desire to deceive others, as when a teacher conceals from his students something he knows. And karana-apatava, weakness of the senses, as when a person, even with a focused mind, is unable to discern some object. So pramada means you're not paying attention, you're not trying to perceive. And karana-apatava means even when you try to perceive, you just can't get it. Your senses can't reach. Because of these natural faults, no mortal can be perfectly reasonable on his own strength, no matter how diligently he tries. To err is human. Dharma, the eternal principles of human responsibility, stood originally like a mighty bull with four legs: mercy, cleanliness, truthfulness, and self-control. Each yuga in the cycle of four has seen a loss of one of these legs of Dharma, with only one leg remaining in Kali Yuga, respect for truth. In our materialistic age, science provides the predominant belief system. We tend to trust the scientific community, by their collective endeavor, will progressively master nature and bring us enduring and ever-improving happiness. And we often assume that truths given us by science are firm and beyond question. But such faith is naive, for the inductive scientific method, like every other human pramana, is prone to error. The ordinary means of acquiring knowledge are especially inadequate for learning about the absolute truth. Sutaram is the word in the verse. Tatra purushasya brahmadi dosha tatushtaya dushtatvat. The predicate's going to be that pratyaksha and the other pramanas are faulty, inadequate, sadoshani. The reason? Because they're polluted by ordinary people's brahma and other three inadequacies. Another reason, especially because they can't access understanding of the absolute truth, which is transcendental. Even if they're functioning properly, our ordinary means are inadequate to understand the absolute truth. Alaukika achincha sobhava vastu sparsha yogyatvat. Because they're not fit for making contact with an object whose nature is inconceivable and transcendental. They're just not equipped for that. Okay, going back to the commentary. Although physical scientists, the ordinary means of acquiring knowledge are especially adequate for learning about the absolute truth, which is not a measurable thing of this world, and which refuses to reveal itself to speculators and skeptics. Although physical scientists may claim to know the basic laws of nature, these laws consisting of knowledge of how mechanical forces interact and how we can manipulate them for our own aims, provide only relative truth. This understanding of things is not complete. Complete understanding requires that we know not only how to use things, but also what their ultimate causes and purposes are. Though the laws of physics tell us how to measure and predict the physical forces among objects, they say nothing about what or who first brought these forces into being and why these forces and objects exist. A basic premise of spiritual science is that underlying all existence is a unity, an absolute truth, tattva, and that everything thus has definite causes and purposes. Human intelligence that ignores this premise remains poor. First of all, assume that there is an absolute truth, and that everything is related to that absolute truth and has some purpose in relationship to the absolute truth. That's the basic premise that we can call monism. Monism doesn't apply just to the impersonalist Mayavadis. Monism means belief that there is one absolute truth. Everything is one. We also ascribe to that, but in a different way. There's one absolute truth, but it has manifold energies and relationships with those energies. That's assumption. Jiva Goswami is assuming that. Those who cannot accept such an outlook are not going to be able to follow along with us. They'll have to go, they won't be able to accept this philosophical presentation. It's based on the assumption that there is an absolute truth. We're not questioning that. We're questioning, can we know the absolute truth and how can we know it? Whether there is an absolute truth, that we're assuming that there is. And that everything is related to that absolute truth. In the Sarasamvadini, Sri Jiva Goswami discusses the 10 means of knowing recognized in the various schools of Indian philosophy. In that discussion, he demonstrates that knowledge derived from oral reception of revealed scripture is the most reliable. So the Tathasandarbha text itself passes by this important point quickly. Sarasamvadini stops and deals with it more thoroughly. It's a real stumbling block for modern thinkers to accept the authority of scripture. Critical thinkers, people who are trained up in the West, especially in the universities, they cannot accept generally the authority of scripture. They're not supposed to. It disqualifies them as serious thinkers to accept something just on say-so. We have to question authority, which means to doubt. We have to doubt, not accept any authority. So there is a problem. If we're going to convince such critical thinkers, like most of the people in the world, at least among those people in the world who do some thinking, which is a minority, but most of the thinking is skeptical thinking or critical thinking. Whatever thinking there is usually critical thinking. To convince critical thinkers to accept the authority of scripture is not easy. I didn't make a whole big attempt of that here. I don't even know exactly how to go about it, how to convince a critical person to accept the authority of scripture. It mostly comes by association and just by having a good heart and accepting spiritual association, and something changes in him. It really, I don't think it's accomplished by argument. I don't see how you can, by argument, convince a skeptic of the authority of the Vedas. The real argument is just that, look, there are so many people through the centuries who have accepted the Vedic authority and are decent people, are reliable people, reputable people who have good opinions, and there's so many of them. So, all these people can't be, it's unlikely they're all wrong. it's really just on the testimony of people, of the good people, trustworthy people who accept the Vedas, that another intelligent person should also accept the Vedas. Otherwise, you can't prove it by mathematics or logic. Yes. Okay. So let's we'll stop here, and tomorrow we'll start the service on Vadini. Yes.
So as far as I know, we have Baladev Vidyabhushana's scripture. What was it called? Vedanta Siamantaka, yeah. Which actually, by the way of an argument, it's attempting to establish Shabda Pramana of the Vedas as the...
almost everything that's in that book, basically everything that's in that book is also there in... if you put together both Baladev's commentary on the Tathasandarbha and Jiva Goswami's Sarasamvadini on this verse, all the same material is there.
So that means that...
And there's also controversy whether Baladev wrote it or his guru wrote it.
So that means that the method of establishing Vedic Pramana is not really, how to say, impossible through the argument. There is some possibility that somebody may accept it through the argument.
I don't think not just by argument. There has to be trust. You have to accept someone's opinion. There's a gap of accepting another person's opinion that has to be crossed. Without that, if you don't trust the opinions of the person who's trying to convince you, all the logic in the world won't change your mind. In this kind of thing, you know, accepting, having faith in the authority of the Vedas can't be imposed just by logic. You can't, you know, there's no way to prove it just by mechanical logic.
So then the purpose of such arguments presented by acharyas, like here in Sarvasamvadini and by Baladev Vidyabhushana, is basically not really to make someone accept the Shastra as ultimate pramana, but to remove the obstacles, the mental obstacles that might impede one to do that.
Well, it's an attempt to convince people to change people's minds. But it's sort of not expecting that many people's minds will be changed. It's an attempt to try. And borderline cases, people who almost have enough faith, they can be won over by such arguments. People who are almost on the verge of accepting anyway. But people who are stubbornly refusing, these arguments won't change them much. And those who are accepted, but whose faith needs to be supported, and whose understanding is weak, this is especially for them, for neophyte devotees. Especially, they need to understand philosophically the basis of Shabda Pramana. But those who reject Shabda Pramana, they're not going to accomplish much by singing to them the glories of Shabda Pramana. They won't accept it. Madan Mohan Prabhu had his hand first.
I just want to run by you this understanding that these devotees, pure devotees, or pure or not pure, anyway, sincere devotees who are trying to use arguments and logic or some other means of preaching, they just use them as means of communication their faith or spiritual experience to people in different ways. Because looks like for some people who are very much conditioned by intelligence, everything has to be very logical. And Krishna speaks about such people in the Bhagavad Gita, saying that someone who studies this sacred conversation with you is worshipping me by his intelligence. In other words, intelligence is not used as a means of understanding, but as a means of worship.
Yes.
So it looks like such devotees as Baladev Vidyabhushana and Jiva Goswami himself, who have employed very thorough and consistent logic.
But there's... Go ahead.
They've communicated their... that spiritual experience you are talking about, Shabda Praman, and they, as Nityananda Prabhu said, they once on the one hand they remove the obstacles, but on the other hand they also use a particular language which people can understand better, and through that knowledge they inject the spiritual experience. I once heard a lecture by
experience and conviction.
And conviction, yeah.
It's your personal conviction that impresses people.
Yes, I once heard a lecture by Hridayananda Maharaj, and he said he is very experienced in scientific preaching, and he said he is a wonderful, brilliant logician besides other qualifications. He said that there is no way to convince people by argument or logic unless we give them some prasadam or some spiritual experience we communicate to them.
Yes.
Then it becomes conclusive. Otherwise, people will just be knocked over, maybe, but
yeah,
they will not
admit
it. Yeah,
defeat them, but not win them over.
I ask a question.
But there are certain things that cannot be proven, and there are other things that can be proven. You can't prove the existence and the supremacy of God, but you can prove that you're mortal. You know, you can show good scientific evidence that everybody's going to die. You know, so there are things that are of use to know, and that people are stubborn to accept. You can use logic to prove it to them. So it does have use. It's just that the really important questions are beyond logic. But there are other practical questions that are useful, like the fact that I'm not going to live forever. That can be established by scientific evidence.
I guess, in one of his discourses, he drew a line between what could be proven, what could not be.
Yes.
And he recourse to the statement by Ramanujacharya, who said that by logic you can prove that God exists, but you cannot prove who that God is. So, in other words, by any further than that, so that's like even intelligent design theories, which are very much abound
yes.
these days.
Yes.
They can prove. They aim at proving that there is some intelligent designer. But who that intelligent designer is, that's beyond the scope of logic, because he's a dakshas, and that has to be based on...
So it would be an impractical waste of time to spend your whole life proving that God exists, and then at the end of it, he could be anybody. You know, then you really haven't accomplished what needs to be accomplished.
I'll ask you a question about definition of knowledge, if possible. Or you wanted other devotees to ask questions first or something?
Go ahead.
Because there was a discussion on West Conference on PEMHO, and devotees were discussing the definition of knowledge in our line, in our philosophy. And they remarked that it seems that in our philosophy we identify pramanas with prama, the correct knowledge. In other words, oftentimes, like Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, he says, this is knowledge, and he lists different ways of behavior, which may not appear to anyone as knowledge itself proper, but as means of attaining. I think acharyas, most of them comment on that verse, that these are the means.
This goes back, it's not, don't blame just Krishna or Sampradaya.
This goes back to
Gautama Rishi in the Nihaya Sutras. He confuses it a bit too. Uh-huh. He you know, gives strict definition, and then he takes liberty to use pramana to mean both the means and the result. Grammatically, that's possible. Your pramana, yat pramiyate tat pramanam, yena pramiyate tat pramanam. So, but that, you know, a strict, really strict philosophy should avoid that kind of ambiguity. Hmm. But it's there, the ambiguity is there, even in the original Nyaya Sutras.
Mm-hmm. So
but you can live with it, you can live with it. You just have to be thoughtful and distinguish, you know, which meaning of pramana am I dealing with here? You can always tell from context.
Is there any way, because there is a need, is there any way to define knowledge strictly in our philosophical line of thought, to define knowledge itself, not the pramanas, not the ways of knowing things properly?
Well, yes, but we do. The Vaishnavacharyas have not much of a problem with how Gautama Rishi formulated it and how it was explained by later commentaries in the Nyaya school. They make some modifications. Later Acharyas in the Madhva line, Jayatirtha, others. Madhva wrote some books. Yeah, he wrote Katha Lakshanam, Vada Lakshanam, where he discusses epistemology. And Vedanta Deshika in the Sri Sampradaya wrote Nyaya Parishuddhi, which is a commentary on the second commentary on the Nyaya Sutras, Udyotakar's Nyaya Vartika. So these Vaishnavacharyas are taking the Nyaya school presentation of how you know and giving some modification on it to fit the Vaishnav Siddhanta. Basically, we can accept Gautama's epistemological presentation, not as ideas of what exists, but as ideas of how you know, and then we modify it to correct some misunderstandings or mistakes. So it's there. Tradition is there. I don't know if we have any Gaudiya Vaishnav book on that level, but it's not in other sampradayas. Closest is Baladev Vidyabhushan's discussions. This Vedanta Sharmantaka is a small book. There are major books by him, the Siddhanta Dharpana, and of course is Govinda Bhasha and Sukshmatika. In these books he discusses epistemological questions also. And the commentary on Tattvasandarbha. And then Jiva Goswami in the Sarvasambhadini. These are our Gaudiya Vaishnav foundational texts on epistemology. Siddhanta Ratna, not Siddhanta Dharpana. Siddhanta Dharpana is a different book. Siddhanta Ratna is a what is it called? It's Bhashya Pitakam. It's a introduction, major introduction to the Govinda Bhasha. With that sub commentary by Baladev himself. That's a major book. You want to get into it, you read the Siddhanta Ratna. Okay, I'll get to you, but Bardram was first.
You say that this Nyaya school, they say that something exists, then it can be known.
It can be named.
Can be named. So then God is named, and then there are people who knew God. And so do they say that everyone has to be able to know it? It has to be known to everyone? Like there may be some fools and there may be some intelligent people?
No, it can be known. Not that everybody necessarily is able to know. Some people are not equipped to properly know certain things. Some things are just, above the intellectual capacity of certain people. Many things. I know that there's Mongolia because I saw some photographs and they taught me about it in geography in the sixth grade. Someone else who never went to school and never left his village may not know that there's a place called Mongolia, may be ignorant of it. So not everybody knows everything, but somebody can know. Or basically any human being could be taught, if he was taught properly. Knowable, not that everybody does know, but everybody could know. Or at least somebody can know, at least.
So the knowability is known for sure only when someone knows it.
Yes. Although, I just, toward the end of Bhagavad Sandarbha, there's a section where Jiva Goswami points out that actually everybody knows God in a certain way, indirectly, through his energy, through his influence. Almost everybody knows something about the influence of God in his own life and in the world. He may not be thinking about it, but it could be pointed out, and almost anybody can understand. So everybody can know God to some extent.
Another question was, when a person tries to define what is the absolute, first thing is when they know what is absolute, but when he tries to define what is absolute, isn't it that he's trying to get on a vantage point and observe the absolute from a position wherein he is not a part of it, which is flawed because we are a part of the truth. So
it's a flawed method.
Yeah,
especially any person who doesn't know already, a person in ignorance of the absolute truth, wants to acquire knowledge of the absolute truth, he has no power to do it. He has to tam twa panishitam purusham pachami. He has to accept the Shruti, the scriptures. Otherwise, he has no access to understanding the absolute truth. An ignorant person cannot be informed about the absolute truth unless he gets that information from the Shastra. Only way to know the absolute truth, Brahman. Yeah.
So only way to know is that. So if now before even determining knowability, if there is before even determining knowability,
yes.
If there is a drive to know something,
a drive to know. Okay.
Yeah.
So if there's no interest, just could be two reasons why there's no interest. You already know everything, or you don't care.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're in ignorance, but you're satisfied to be in ignorance. Or you already know everything, or you think you already know everything, and therefore there's no drive.
But to know God, everyone wants to know God.
Like, does everybody want to know God?
I mean, they may not be serious about it, but
Okay.
So the drive is there. I mean, even in the tribe, they have some way of worshipping God. Like, they make a very crude
worship.
That's
human beings. What about animals?
We don't know.
Okay. Yes.
So if there is a drive to know something, is that also... So can it be theorized
that's
that...
That's gigyasa. Yeah. Atato brahma gigyasa. First of all, let's have some inquiry, some interest in knowing the absolute truth.
Just like if we have thirst, then we have to be sure... Then that itself, isn't it enough proof that there is water? So...
Wow. Well, that's one attempt at proving that because there's an urge to get water, there must be some water. That's an argument. I don't know if it'll convince everybody.
Okay. What are the opinions?
It may be a correct argument, but it may not win everybody over. Because, you know, I have an urge to become God. I can't become God. So that's a false urge. So maybe the urge to know the absolute truth is a false urge. You know, religion is the opiate of the people. Yeah. If it's a true urge, okay, but if it's an illusory urge, I don't know. Yes? I'm sorry, Vishnu Khan, we'll get back to you.
Okay. Just on Varam's point, as in one of Bhaktivedanta Purnamaraj's classes one time, Ipar, and he made an interesting point that even the standpoint of the atheists is based on the existence of God, because without the existence of God, they have nothing to try and refute. They have, you know, all their whole standpoint is based on
the idea of God.
The idea of God, yeah.
Of course, then there's some recent atheists don't want to be called atheists for that reason. Vishnu Kautika?
As you know, this Vedic knowledge is divided into paravidya and aparavidya, and it was explained that aparavidya is the mundane knowledge, is it? Paravidya is
what the Mundaka Upanishad says is an understanding of the Rig Veda and other scriptures. But that means the lower understanding.
Yeah. So aparavidya is anything related to material world.
But it depends how you look at it. Mundaka Upanishad is not talking about, you know, technological knowledge and material knowledge. He's talking about Vedic knowledge and calling that apara.
Yeah, it means anything.
Karmakanda knowledge, but it's still Vedic.
Anything material inside Vedas.
Well, okay, but what about material things that are outside the Vedas? Then they're not even knowledge. Agyanam yadato nyata. Everything else is, you know, you can call it knowledge, but it isn't.
So, the aparavidya is anything that can be measured through the material substances of the gross and subtle bodies that are awarded to everyone. I mean, they are under the domain of perception. And,
okay.
So, but the paravidya or the part which is linking to something beyond the perception of the gross.
Yaya tadaksharam adhikamyate. That by which you can know the infallible. That's the paravidya.
Yeah, paravidya. So, what the attempt is made now in the, especially preaching, in the college preaching and all, especially IITs and all, they try to use this logic powerfully in order to establish the validity of the aparavidya sections of the Vedic scriptures. So that is done by comparing and contrasting the modern scientific advancements along with the the facts that are presented in the Aparavidya sections, where like different parts of Vedas, like the Dhanurveda and different other things, so many comparisons are made and proved that all those are scientifically valid, and even beyond the advancement, the current advancement the science and technology has made. So, and several scientists have also been like involved in this research and all, and they are told that most of the things that are explained in certain sections of Aparavidya that can be practical, in a sense. Now science is not ready, but maybe after,
you know, that can also go ahead.
So like initially in the preaching they established this fact, and after proving this they take certain statements in those sections that Paravidya is something even beyond this, and then they, after making people convincing that this is true, this is completely valid and a proof, then they go to the Paravidya and say that this you need to, you can understand only by Shabda Praman. There's no other way of perceiving the Paravidya section.
Why didn't Jiva Goswami do that? This is nervous. Why didn't he go through great lengths to prove to skeptical people the authority of the Vedas?
I'm
a little doubtful whether making a huge endeavor to do this is the right way to preach.
Maybe
you know, over endeavor in it. You know, some attempted it, but you really have to see, have you really convinced, who have you actually convinced by all this, and what have you convinced them of? Just like we were talking about proving that the existence of God, but then you're left with God could be anybody. Same thing. You prove that the Vedas are authority on material matters. You still haven't, you know, convinced anybody of the spiritual authority of the Vedas. Even if you went to such length to make, give them some trust in the Vedas on certain, on a mundane level, they still may remain complete materialists and atheists. And they can become nice karmakandi, you know, followers of the Vedas. We don't want to create that. We got enough karmakandis. We don't want to make more. I'm not rejecting, but I got some doubt that you could go off on a tangent on this approach.
But those
and not, you know, you got to be careful. Measure very carefully how you're actually convincing people. If you convince people, then you've done the right thing.
So, but it's seen that those who are really inquisitive, they understand this, and then they want to go further. So
well,
for those people,
okay,
say
you're saying that, but in you know, the real statistics.
Yeah, it is happening like that. Like recently in my...
Well, okay, you know, the thing is, you can attract people, but what are you, you know, and, but what are you attracting them to? Are you giving them pure Krishna consciousness? You may attract followers, but then not give them Krishna. So I'm just expressing, you know, sort of gnawing doubt whether going, you know, making a huge endeavor out of that approach, whether it's practical.
So this whole foundation is acting as a bridge between those critical thinkers and Srila Prabhupada's books.
Yeah, okay, but if the bridge doesn't reach to the other end, then, you know, does it? Does it actually gap, you know, bridge the gap, or is it just go halfway? That's my doubt.
Actually, I witnessed this personally, a group of more than 100 boys from various IITs and NITs in India, in Mayapur they had gathered, and there was very, very strong logical arguments for many, many hours.
Yes.
And after that, they were taken to various places like Gurukula and different Bhakti Vijayapurna Maharaj, different Maharaj spoke to them.
Yes.
And then they were all like encouraged to read Prabhupada's books, and then they were like trained in that way.
Okay. Then that's, you know, if it actually gets results, sure. But then it has to be done by someone expert. It's a very specialized job. To do, you know, to take that approach of convincing people philosophically of the authority of the Vedas and then making them into devotees, you've got to have some very deep knowledge and some special shakti to be able to do that. Yes?
It may again be another good example of how different devotees, different preachers use different approaches and means of communicating the same message. Because I remember Radhanath Maharaj and Niranjana Maharaj, they were describing how they preached in US in the same among the same high grade students like MIT University.
Yes.
And institutes like that. So what they would do, they would just walk around, ride around, and they would teach them how to make chapatis. So they would give them, they go give out rolling pins and pieces of dough, and they would just show them how to roll chapatis. There was very little logic involved.
Yes.
But it was fun for them, and they grew to appreciate devotees. And then of those people, they selected some, chose some more people who would be more receptive, and then they taught, not based on logic, but based on, maybe logic was also involved, of course, there, but mostly because of their personal experience of association with devotees who are entirely different people. So in other words, just like these logical discourses, which may be very prominent and very useful things of introducing people to hearing from devotees, it may be as effective in some high top-end institutes of India and yes. In America, it may be.
And when done expertly.
Yeah, when done expertly, with the idea.
In expert hands, it's not going to be effective. But if someone really expert, it could be very effective. Okay. Yes.
And the expertise probably is that the preacher himself does not, or herself does not believe that by logic or by rolling chapatis when we can make people devotees. So it's none of those. It's the experience and the conviction of the preacher and his pure motive, which gets communicated through these two means, or everything between them.
Well, if you roll chapatis in love and offer them to Krishna, you can make devotees.
Yeah. Or we could use logic for worshiping Krishna, the same way Krishna
says
in Bhagavad Gita.
If you have firm faith, you can use your logic and convince people.
But it's not the material means in themselves. They're necessarily better than the other means that we use to communicate things.
No. I think we're late. So, excuse me if it sounded like I'm rejecting the approach, but it has to be done expertly. And it's only a few preachers are going to be able to do it, and it's a target for a very targeted audience. Okay, thank you, all glories to Srila Prabhupada, Sri Jiva Goswami, Sri Tattva Sandarbha, Ki Jai.